Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. This morning, we catch up with a sitting congressman and a former one. U.S. Representative Ed Case lays out his position on immigration after catching some flack from Democratic colleagues on his vote on certain bills. He also has some choice words about the president's spending bill. On today's Mono Minute, we meet a bird that spends most of its life at sea. Plus, we learn about Kauai's soon-to-be-released climate plan. And we bookend our show with an interview with former Congressman Kai Kahele. He talks about the direction that the Office of Hawaiian Affairs is headed under his leadership as chairman of the Board of Trustees. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. At federal court earlier this morning, a number of immigrants became U.S. citizens in a naturalization ceremony. It's an event that U.S. Representative Ed Case says he's been invited to attend in the past. Case often votes independently from members of the Hawaii delegation, and he recently came under fire from fellow Democrats for voting in favor of the SAVE Act, a bill that makes sweeping reforms to voter registration. Case unexpectedly found a week to return to the islands when Republicans canceled sessions just before passing the president's spending bill last week. Case calls the new legislation terrible and just cruel. He took a break from walking door to door in Kalihi to drop by our studios and laid out his stance on immigration issues.
My Republican majority colleagues at the last minute on July 3rd canceled this week in Washington, and it was pretty sudden. And I think really what was happening was that, of course, the last vote that we had, which was last July 3rd, was the vote on the reconciliation budget bill, a terrible bill. I voted against it with no hesitation. Very controversial. We can get into the impacts on Hawaii. And I think my colleagues on the other side just decided they needed to go home and try to explain a terrible bill. And maybe they just felt like they didn't want to be in Washington anymore. But whatever reason, I think it was the wrong decision because we have a lot of work to do. So I had an unexpected week back home, and I'm doing something that I did a couple of months ago. I felt that I was not sufficiently in touch with the broad range of my constituents. I was hearing very actively from tens of thousands of my constituents, but I have 725,000. And I felt that although I knew exactly what a small part of my constituency felt about what was going on in the broader range, I didn't have a good enough vibe, a good enough connection. And that's something that's really critical to me. So a couple of months ago, I was home for a week and I basically told my staff, you know what, I'm going to cancel everything this week and I'm going to go walk. I'm going to go walk my district. And each day, I'm going to pick one part of my district and I'm going to no schedule. I'm going to just say, okay, we're going to go there. We're going to walk. We're going to find people where they live, where they work, where they play. We're going to walk into stores, small businesses, walk down streets and talk to anybody that's out walking or is, out and about. And that particular week, we covered neighborhoods such as, Hawaii Kai, Mililani, Evakapale, Waipahu, Pearl City. And so now that I had this open week, I basically told myself, I'm going to go do that
again.
So I just finished my second full day. Yesterday, I spent in Palolo and Kaimuki. Today, I was in Kalihi right before I came down here. So Kalihi, way up in the valley, Kalihi Central, and then Kalihi Kai.
What is on people's minds? What are their fears right now?
Many are concerned for our country. So that is a mainstream concern of everybody. Some people are more directly impacted by the changes of the Trump administration. Some people are not directly impacted, but they certainly feel a queasiness at best and an outright concern. Beyond that, the cost of living still predominates, as we all know it should. That should be our number one priority. Cost of housing, the cost of fuel. We certainly have concerns with, crime, which is very much on people's minds. Healthcare is a major issue for many, many of the people that I talk to. Small businesses are directly impacted by the president's tariff wars because the products that they sell here depend on imports, many of them, directly or indirectly, whether they're coming straight here from elsewhere or they get shipped from another country to the continent and, manufactured into the final product and brought down here. So all of those things are on people's minds. So, you know, I'm not encountering a happy constituency or anything like that. And I completely feel the same way.
I know that the spending bill went through the House. One of the topics was a tax on remittance. And, you know, that stands to affect a large number of people who send money back to the Philippines, China, I think the Marshallese. It was a 5%. I think it went down to 3.5%. I don't know where it is now.
I don't know. That's an 867-page bill that got put on my desk less than 24 hours before the final vote. So I'm still understanding what's in that bill. And that in itself is a very bad comment on Congress. That shouldn't happen. You know, I should know the answer to that. I knew that remittances was an issue in the bill when it passed out of the House and was in the Senate, but I don't know what the final answer is. Just take today, walking North King Street. You know, I headed Eva from Kalihi and North King, and I simply walked those small businesses all the way down to the shopping center and back. And I would say that maybe I walked into 10 remittances to the Philippines. And that's a major connection between our state, our country, and a friend and an ally and a partner. And by the way, the ancestral homeland of an incredible number of people right here in Hawaii. And so that connection of being able to come here and earn a good living and make some money and help your family out back home, that's good for everybody. That's good for our state. That's good for our country. And it's certainly good for the Philippines. I think the figure is correct that in the Philippines, remittances is something like the second or third largest income source.
I've been trying to get the numbers, good numbers, on how much Hawaii sends back. You know, I've seen the national numbers. But when I called up the Philippine National Bank, which is one of the big players, they said they do 2.5 million every month. And I was like, wow.
Just the Philippine National Bank. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the people that I was, the stores that I was walking into, that's not the Philippine National Bank. Those are remittance services that go through various servicers. But they were all very busy.
And so that's something to consider. We haven't heard a lot about that impact to the community. But there is a lot of focus on immigration and the crackdown of the borders. And I understand that you got some heads up about the federal detention center here. What can you share with us about that?
You know, if we're going to talk about immigration, first of all, I would like to talk about the big picture of immigration before we get into any specific issue. Because we have many, many controversial issues in immigration right now. But my observation and comment is that we're not having these discussions on specific issues in the context of a bigger picture about what we actually want with immigration. What is our immigration system supposed to accomplish, and how do we want to accomplish that? And here's my take on it. And not everybody will agree with what I'm about to say, but I think most people do agree with what I believe is the big picture. First, legal immigration is good for our country. Legal immigration is good for our state. And it is part of our American experience. It's certainly part of our experience here in Hawaii. And we should strengthen and expand legal immigration. Now, some people don't think we should. I do. I think we need to expand legal immigration significantly for a lot of different reasons. And so how do we do legal immigration? Okay, so that's point one. Point two, we cannot accept this level of illegal immigration into our country, which in the last couple of decades, under numerous presidents, numerous congressional majorities reached terrible proportions, just way too big, because we were not enforcing our immigration laws. And we can't go on with that. Point number three, we have over 10 million estimated people that are in our country illegally today. Some have been here for decades, some have been here for months. And obviously, we have to deal with illegal immigrants in our country today. And that involves some level of detention and deportation. But to pretend that we can simply round up an estimated 11 million illegal immigrants and deport them all, I think is the wrong thing to do, unrealistic, is kind of a blanket solution to a problem that's far more, you know, nuanced than that.
Yeah, it's impractical.
And so we clearly have to confront that reality and decide, okay, for the people that are here illegally, which of those should we focus on deporting? And which of those should we try to consider whether there's another path, a path to citizenship? And then we have some very serious issues, for example, with, you know, children who came here young and for all intents and purposes are Americans.
Right.
The deferred acceptance of, DACA children. And I believe that we should have a path to citizenship for them. So those are my four big areas. And as part of that, we have to be able to enforce our immigration system. One of the basic problems we have is we can't enforce it fully right now. And what does that really mean? Enforcement means that we, this country, are capable of saying who can come here and what can come here, by the way, because it's not just people, it's also goods and services. Who and what can come here, when and under what conditions? And we have the ability to enforce those rules. And the breakdown in immigration right now, one of the breakdowns in a broken immigration system is an inability to enforce those rules. And I think that's a reality that we all have to face. And it is fraught with political discussion.
Right. And you've taken heat for this.
I've taken a lot of heat for saying these things pretty straight out. Now, I don't believe that we should enforce our immigration system in a way that violates law. I believe that due process is central to our to the enforcement of our immigration system. I believe in fairness. I believe in not doing it in a haphazard and threatening manner. It should be done, you know, as humanely as possible. And that's where I come out on it. As I walked through Kalihi, I was talking with a lot of my constituents who are first generation in this country. And I would talk to them about immigration. What do you think? You will find that people that came into our country legally, who waited sometimes for 10 to 20 years, they applied and then they just waited, right? So the wait time for example, immigrant from the Philippines can be 10 plus years. And that's legal. And so, you know, the people I was talking to today are like, well, hey, I did it legally. And so obviously we can't just accept illegal immigration and we have to enforce our laws. So that's the big picture of immigration. And, you know, there are, again, political extremes on both sides that take a different position. One side says, basically, we should have no legal immigrants at all, and we should, you know, deport 11 million and no pathway, no exceptions. And the other side basically says, no, we should open up the borders and not enforce anything. And,
well, we're having this discussion, and in our studio, we have a replica of the Statue of Liberty here, and who welcomes the masses and the tired.
I'm a believer in that. I totally believe in that. But we have a broken, dysfunctional immigration system right now, and the decisions that we have to make to fix it and to have a functioning immigration system are hard decisions.
That was Congressman Ed Case, who unexpectedly had a free week from hearings in our nation's capital and returned home to connect with his constituents. We'll have more of our conversation coming up. Let's get back to U.S. Representative Ed Case, who swung by HBR yesterday, taking a break from walking his district. Case shared that he was recently alerted that the federal detention center at the Honolulu airport was being eyed by the Bureau of Prisons to send immigrants rounded up by the Immigration and Customs agents on the mainland. Here's Case.
3 weeks ago, I got a notice, which was a pretty innocuous notice. This is from the Bureau of Prisons, which operates the federal detention center. And so my office and I were notified, I think this was somewhere around 3 weeks ago. Quote, Bureau of Prisons will update its interagency agreement with the United States Immigration and Customs Enforcement to house its detainees in additional Bureau of Prisons facilities, including Federal Detention Center Honolulu. ICE will soon place detainees in two housing units at FDC Honolulu, one male and one female. Detainees will be housed in their own units. So that opens up a lot of questions, right? The Federal Detention Center Honolulu, there is space available there. They don't use it. And I've talked with folks that, you know, work there, and I've talked with the people that run Federal Detention Center Honolulu. They're not equipped personnel-wise, safety-wise, fitting out of the cells. We're talking about basics like, you know,
they're not staffed.
They don't have the equipment to handle a huge influx of people from anywhere. And so we've reached back out to Bureau of Prisons and said, okay, fine, tell us the details. How many? Where are they from? When? What have you done in terms of conditions of providing for humane detention? And I'm waiting for that answer. I mean, they told me 3 weeks ago. Now, what I suspect is happening is exactly what your question is, which is that they have an overflow on the continent and they need to detain some here.
Well, I know that there are people on the state, and this call has come out years ago where the state should consider purchasing the federal detention center for its inmates here. And it's come up again recently, but I don't know if this administration is going to be keen on that.
No, and I've been central to that. When I got into office in 2019 and 2020, there was a pretty significant move by the state to consider whether they could, in fact, buy the federal detention center and or use it and lease it. And I actually went through a long process with the Bureau of Prisons through my membership on the Appropriations Committee. At the time, I was on the subcommittee that oversees the Department of Justice and the Bureau of Prisons. So I had direct oversight responsibility there.
So is it likely?
It's not. And the reason is, first of all, basic expense. As it turns out, the state doesn't save money by using extra space at the federal detention center. Federal detention center, a very expensive place to build, very expensive place to operate. Mm. It's got tremendous operational issues that are, I don't think the state wants to take over, for example, the electric bill at the federal detention center, just to use one example. And number two, it turns out to be quite difficult to merge a state system of detention and imprisonment and a federal system of detention and imprisonment in terms of, you know, how you operate common doors. You know, you have different security issues, you have different personnel issues, you have different, in some cases, unions, you have different procedures. And so it's not simple to simply say, oh, well, let's just rent us some space. No, it's not
practical.
That simple. So I took it as far as I could. And after that, I think the state decided, this is just not worth pursuing any further. And of course, the state is still struggling with the basic issue of detention and imprisonment space in the state.
For the rest of the week, what's your plan? To continue walking the neighborhood?
I'm going to keep walking. I enjoy it greatly. And I find that it clears things up because this is just, it's no surprise here, but this is the most intense time I've ever had in public service. There is so much anger, so much division, so much polarization, so much that this administration is doing that I not just disagree with on a policy basis, but that I think threatens the foundations of our country. So if it's a policy disagreement within the foundations of our country, then that's something that you have to work yourself through. But when it's a threat to the country itself, that is different. And so I think what happens, obviously, in our world today is just a tremendous amount of anger, people yelling and screaming at each other, and the level of constant noise around you.
It's a 10 every day.
It's a 10 every day, especially in Washington, D.C. And again, I find that I need to very consciously make sure that I'm in touch with my constituents, who I owe my loyalty to, and all of my constituents, not just the people that write me every day and tell me what they think.
We have heard that part of the reason why we're in this situation where our democracy is threatened is that the Democrats have lost touch with the people.
Well, I think there's some truth to that. I think both parties probably lost touch with, quote unquote, the people. I think both parties have lost touch with the people on specific issues, some issues worse than others for whatever party. For example, we've spent a long time here talking about immigration. And I think the Democratic Party has lost touch with the mainstream of America on immigration. I don't think that I don't think that we have articulated a policy that most Americans agree with.
We've gone too far. We need to tighten
up. We've gone too far. We have let this get out of control. We have not acknowledged it. I mean, people are pretty willing to forgive you for not getting it if you just say, oh, I missed that. Yeah, and I'm sorry. And let's get back on track. We haven't done that yet. The Republicans passed a terrible bill, an absolutely terrible, cruel bill. The reconciliation bill is a cruel bill. And I think the American people do not agree with that bill.
What are the two top things that bother you the most?
I'm going to cheat on you and go more than two, because I think there's really four big things that are wrong with the bill. The first is that it attacks a social safety net of two generations now to help people that really need help, that need help with health care. So it attacks Medicaid. We've got a lot of people in Hawaii that are on Medicaid.
So what's the second one?
Second one is food assistance, supplemental nutrition. Third one is it blows the federal budget by up to $5 trillion. $5 trillion. And this is supposed to be the party of fiscal discipline. If you're in that party, don't talk to me about fiscal discipline anymore, because you're not the party of fiscal discipline. You just passed the biggest deficit bill in the history of our country, and you just pretended it wasn't an issue. So, don't even talk about that.
It's a big number three.
And then finally, it reverses decades of progress we've made on trying to convert to a renewable energy future. So it doubles down on fossil fuels, and I think that's just a foolish thing to do in the big picture. And I'm happy I'm from a state that has, you know, really been a pioneer in this area, but it's going to make it a lot harder for us to do that. And so if you add all of those things up, I just think that those themes are not consistent with where most Americans are, regardless of what party you're in.
Okay. Representative Case, thank you so much for carving out time for us.
Thank you so much. As always, my contact is case.house.gov for any information. And one thing that I just want to point out very brief, in the interest of continuing to stay in touch with my constituents, I'm going to do another live district-wide teletalk story on July 29th, 6 p.m. in the evening. So I'll do it live, answer questions, and see what's on people's minds. So all that information is going to be at case.house.gov.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming in again.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from U.S. Representative Ed Case, who explained his position on immigration issues and about the notice he got from the Bureau of Prisons about sending immigrants from the continent to the Honolulu Federal Detention Center. He also shared his thoughts about the controversial spending bill that President Donald Trump signed into law last week. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Summer in Hawaii means it's also Obon season. For almost every weekend until the end of September, Japanese Buddhist temples will be aglow with lanterns and filled with music and dance. The tradition of Obon dances is said to have originated when a close disciple of the Buddha discovered his deceased mother suffering and asked Buddha how to free her. Buddha told him to prepare a feast for the monks returning from a summer retreat. When his mother was released, he danced with joy, creating the first Bon Odori, or Bon Dance, to honor and remember those who have passed. While Obon in Japan is mainly observed for just a weekend, you can find dances taking place all summer long in Hawaii, as the tradition is one of the largest sources of fundraising for temples. Besides the dancing, Bon dances are also known for their food. From yakisoba to andagi, there are some great bites, but the Soto Zen Temple in Hanapepe claims the creation of a certain dish that many say is out of this world delicious. For today's backyard quiz, can you name the signature Hawaii festival food? If you think you know this bite, call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nairit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are working to provide affordable housing programs to transition renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NairitHawaii.com.
We now go to this week's Manu Minute. UH Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to an endangered Hawaiian seabird with a distinctive mating call.
The Oahu, or Hawaiian petrel, is a seabird that spends its entire life at sea, only coming to land in the Hawaiian Islands to breed. Like many Hawaiian birds, Oahu are named after the sound they make. Their haunting calls can be heard at night as they fly mauka to their nests high in the mountains. Yeah. Oahu navigate using the stars, and baby Oahu leaving the nest for the first time get confused by artificial lights and can become grounded. This makes them easy prey for dogs and cats. When Oahu were more abundant around the islands, they were considered a great delicacy, but nowadays they're listed as an endangered species. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Department of Biology at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society. For more than 8 decades, fostering community values that work to protect Hawaii's native birds and ecosystems. Learn more about membership and other ways to help at hiaudubon.org.
Many of us have been following the terrible flooding in Texas this past week with so many young lives lost. And record rainfall is something that Kauai, or Garden Isle, grapples with regularly. The county is expected to finalize its climate adaptation plan later this summer. Here to talk about this is HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. Hi, Savannah.
Hi, Catherine.
Yeah, so what can you tell us about this plan?
Well, I think it's important to understand how climate change is impacting Kauai in order to understand why this plan is necessary. So there are the dramatic impacts, one, namely the 2018 thunderstorm on Kauai that also impacted Oahu. That dropped in some places over 50 inches of rain in 24 hours, which set a national record. And the flooding from that also damaged homes, did, I think, $180 million in damages and cut off access to some communities. And at that time, the Kauai Planning Department, the county-level government, did not have a formal plan in place of how it was going to deal with climate change. And so that was one of the first seeds to say, we really need to organize around all these changes that are happening. The dramatic ones, like the floods that occurred from that rainfall, as well as increased wildfire risk that Kauai is grappling with. So, for instance, just last summer, there were fires that came close to destroying homes in Hanapepe Heights, as well as Kamakani. But there are also subtler changes that are happening on Kauai that I discussed with members of the planning department. Alicia Summers, who works with the planning department, points out that this is really impacting people's daily lives and cultural practices on Kauai.
Cultural resources are also at risk. One that's very dear to us on Kauai is the Hanapepe salt ponds. It's also called the Lo'i Pa'akai o Ukula, and they are already experiencing flooding impacts that can disrupt the salt harvesting over there. We did a talk story with a Limu practitioner who had mentioned to us that they now need to place the cages to cultivate limu farther offshore because the nearshore waters have already become too warm for healthy limu growth. So various different impacts like that.
Wow, that's so interesting. So how does this plan suggest that Kauai deal with these changes?
Well, it's robust, to say the least. It has 79 strategies that are listed just out in part one of how it's going to become more resilient in the face of climate change over the next 10 years. And if that sounds a lot like a lot, there is kind of a top 10 that they've selected of priorities. And those are action items they think will have the greatest impact. But that doesn't mean that they're necessarily the easiest to implement. So, for instance, the shortlist includes relocating residents away from eroding coastlines, which is another huge concern on Kauai. That's a process called managed retreat. And it is a strategy that has faced pushback from some residents in coastal communities across the state. And speaking with Alicia Summers, she acknowledged that asking people to abandon their homes is a delicate topic, even if those properties will inevitably be damaged or destroyed or put in harm's way by rising sea levels. So she wanted to say, at this point, any managed retreat program on Kauai would be voluntary.
Managed retreat is a really complex one. That one is a really tough one. So when thinking about managed retreat as a program for Kauai, right now we are in the exploratory stage. This plan does not necessarily adopt any new ordinance changes in creating like a managed retreat program or forcing the retreat of our different areas, but it is exploring different types of programs, such as the potential for land swaps, but also looking at transfer of development rights, where we could look at how someone in a safer zone basically would be able to buy quote unquote, like almost like development credits from someone in a more vulnerable zone, where they would then be able to sell their credits and maybe not develop to their full extent in that parcel.
Yeah, that's a really interesting concept. But how does the community provide input on this plan?
Right. So this is going to have a big impact on community members. And so they were given multiple opportunities to provide input during the drafting process. Marie Williams, who is also with the Kauai Planning Department, she actually runs their long-range planning division, says that those conversations really helped to shape the plan. One consideration was to put more in the plan about not just how Kauai is adapting, but what it's doing to reduce its own climate impact. So a lot of the conversation in there are strategies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And these are difficult topics to navigate, including things like managed retreat. But William says when residents look to the plan, they're also going to see action items that they've championed throughout the process. And one involves the creation of an urban forestry program.
Something that's come up a bunch through our engagement is the issue of shade and trees. And people would like to have more trees in some of our parks. They would love to have trees along certain sidewalks and pathways as well. But the county doesn't have an active urban forestry program right now. And so we made sure to acknowledge that heat stress will be an issue. I know we don't associate heat stress with our lives here too much, but we will in fact be getting more of those very hot days. What we should do is think of ways that we can invite more shade into our lives and our public spaces. And so one action is in fact to build an urban forestry program through an urban forestry plan. That's just an example of how the actions in this plan aren't only about climate change, they're also about improving people's lives.
So how does this plan get finalized?
So they're expected to have it done by the end of the summer. Then it goes to Mayor Derek Kawakami for his approval. He is expected to approve it. And this conversation has been happening essentially his whole time in office. Those floods in 2018 happened just a few months before he took over as mayor. And once that's set in stone, then, you know, the real work starts, and that's taking all of these suggestions in the plan and turning them into a reality. In part two of the plan, every county department has its own marching orders, and they also really want, the planning department really wants to work with community groups who have already been spearheading climate action in their own communities.
All right. Well, it's all very interesting, but thanks so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from HR's climate and energy reporter, Savannah Harriman-Pote. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And now it's time for the answer to our backyard quiz. Earlier, we traced back the history of bone dances in Japan and Hawaii, including a festival food dish that one temple claims to have created. If you have been to a bone dance on Kauai, chances are you've seen it. On the west side of Kauai in Hanapepe, Soto Zen Temple claims to have originated the dish, selling almost 4,000 of them last bone dance season. The temple credits the recipe of the dish to Mrs. Sueko Tanigawa, who was the cafeteria manager of Ele'ele School in the 1950s. The story goes that someone asked what would a hamburger be like if you made it on a campfire. Shaped like a circular sandwich, it is made with Love's Bakery white bread and filled with a sloppy Joe meat filling, American cheddar cheese, and baked in a pie iron. It's not a bird or a plane. It's a flying saucer. And Destiny from Kahalu called. She's our winner today. She says her husband is from Kauai and has eaten many a flying saucer. I'll have to try one. It's making me hungry. But that's our quiz for today. If you have an idea to share, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from HSO's Sheraton Summer Festival, with Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark in concert July 16th and 17th, the full film with live music at the Blaisdell Concert Hall.
I'm Al Letson, and we're celebrating a decade of Reveal.
Congratulations on 10 years, and keep those compelling stories. Just keep them coming, so we will all, as human beings, understand what other people have gone through in this society.
10 years of great stories on the next Reveal.
Beginning this evening at 7.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
Close out our show with the conversation we had recently with former U.S. Congressman Kai Kahele. He currently serves as chair of the Office of Hawaiian Affairs Board. OHA just passed its budget, which contains a number of firsts. It intends to provide paid leave for its staff in an effort to attract and retain its workers. Kahele catches us up on the future of the office.
Our budget is probably the most impactful policy strategic document that we can pass, because it outlines our goals, the things that we feel can impact our lahui in the most effective, you know, best possible way. And we got it done. You know, this is months in the making. It's $136 million, and it's over the next 2 years, the fiscal biennium 26-27. And it was a incredible process, I think, for myself to go through as a board chair, working with our budget and finance chair, Trustee Luana Lapa. And it ultimately culminated last week, Monday, on the last day of the fiscal year 25. We had to get it done that day. It took us 9 hours. And at the end of that, a supermajority of the Board of Trustees passed our biennium budget with about 6 hours to go before midnight, which is really important, because we didn't want to wake up on July 1st and our employees not knowing if they should come to work, or our beneficiaries or our grantees not knowing if they're going to receive the funds that OHA has funded them. And so it was really important we got that work done.
And so what can you say about the process? Because I understand that some staff were maybe a little taken aback because the approach was a little bit different this time.
It was different. We started this process back in January, February of this year, took it out to community in April. We had something that has never happened before at OHA, at least from what I've heard, is we had budget briefings, just like the legislature. And we did it in May. We had at least 17 budget briefings from each of the divisions and departments at OHA that had a chance to come up to the board table and showcase the hard work that they do and the great work that they do and the requests and resources that they need to even do a better job. And so we did that over the course of May. The administration presented several earlier versions of the budget. And then at the end of the day, the budget and finance chair and myself worked on putting the final touches on the budget that we would present to the Board of Trustees, which we did. You know, at the end of the day, the 9 elected trustees, which are unique. It's different than a elected legislator, because we don't have an executive branch. There is no governor, right, at OHA. The OHA Board of Trustees also have a fiduciary role that's very important in managing almost $1 billion in Native Hawaiian trust assets. And so at the end of the day, those 9 trustees are given the statutory power and the authority to make the final decisions on the board budget. And that's what we did. At the end of the day, 83% of our budget matched the administration's identically. There were some disputes over 17% of the discretionary budget, what amounted to about $2 to $4 million, differences of opinion on how those funds would be spent. I look at it this way. We agreed funds needed to be spent for our beneficiaries. At the end of the day, the trustees made the decision on how best those funds should be spent. And those are decisions that we had to make, and we did.
Okay, and the high points, if you could share with our listeners, what was so significant?
So first and foremost, when I came to OHA in December and assumed the chairmanship, we had a 30% vacancy rate. I met with as many employees as I could over the last few months. One of the things that was contributing to low morale at OHA and internal issues at OHA was the lack of pay equity amongst OHA employees that had not received any meaningful pay raises in the last few years. And so we addressed that pretty early on. We created an ad hoc committee led by Trustee Souza and our Chair Emerita Lindsay. They spent several months looking at every position, every salary at OHA, and ultimately they brought a decision in front of the board which adopted it unanimously. And so every employee at OHA that has been an employee for longer than 2 years that makes $100,000 or less was given anywhere between a 12 to a 22% pay increase in this fiscal year budget. And so that's one thing we did. The other thing we did was we created a teleworking program or a flexible work schedule, which is pretty common in private and in public workplaces. So that's now incorporated at OHA. And then something that I'm really proud that the Board of Trustees did that I think moves the needle on OHA becoming an employer of choice is we established a paid family leave program, which doesn't exist anywhere in Hawaii state government. This is the first time ever. Paid family leave, 12 weeks, 100% of the employee's pay for a parental bonding event or a care of an ill family member event.
So you're really setting the pace.
We are setting a pace that OHA is the place you want to be. We have competitive salaries. We have paid family leave. We have signing bonuses. We have flexible schedule telework policy in place. And we have good work that can be mission-driven and that people can feel really good about when they come to work at OHA every day.
Well, I'll be honest. I know I would call over to OHA and find out, oh, this person's gone. They've gone over and taken a job with the Council for Native Hawaiian Advancement.
Yes,
you know, because they were able to, move faster or offer better benefits and pay.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a reality.
12 weeks paid family leave. This is something that even the legislature has struggled to enact, and we did it at OHA. We are obviously a smaller organization than the entire state government. We have about 120 employees right now. We're budgeted for about up to 170 employees by the time this fiscal biennium budget is completed. And so it's very ambitious, and I think it's very progressive, and it supports our employees and gives them an added benefit that up until now did not exist. If you had a child, you burned your vacation, you burned your sick leave, and then you had to return to work, period.
Right. Yeah.
This is something that our employees can count on. We also made it retroactive back to January 1st because we have a few of our employees that have had children in the last fiscal year, and we want to give them that opportunity too. So that's something. Addressing the internal issues that have been longstanding at OHA was really important. And then we pivot to the other really important things we did. One of the things we did in this budget was we allocated the most amount of financial resources ever to our 17 Hawaiian-focused charter schools. The State Charter School Commission recognizes 17 Hawaiian-focused charter schools across the state from Kauai to Hawaii Island. We allocated more money than they've ever received in the past from OHA because we are expecting looming federal financial cuts that are coming to the Office of Native Hawaiian Education, possibly the elimination of the Department of Education at the federal level. We know that our charter schools, whether they're a small charter school or a big charter school, they struggle in having facilities funding from the ledge.
Yes, big,
so we wanted to
issue.
Give them those resources. So we did. We gave them those resources. We empowered the administrators, the principals, the po'okumus, to deploy those assets as in the best way possible with pretty limited constraints on what OHA would allow them to use the money for. Programmatic funding, facilities funding, they make the choice, they deploy the asset, And we felt that was the best thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, you do want safeguards to make sure that the money is being spent properly.
Yes.
Because we've had some administrators who went astray.
Yeah.
And were taken to task.
Yeah.
Over that. Because, yeah, I mean, this is the money for the kids.
And part of this is we want to have our staff, our administration, have that connective tissue with each individual school. So every 3 months, our staff will be doing quarterly oversight visits, meeting with the administration, meeting with the staff. The semi-annual and final year-end reports will still be due from the school. So we do feel like this is an appropriate time to give more resources, maybe cut some of the bureaucracy, the red tape that had existed in the past, and have our staff be more connected, boots on the ground, out in community with the schools. And
right.
We think that's a good thing.
So empowering them.
Yeah.
What can you say about Hako'one? Because I think when we last chatted, it was before the legislature. I know, they don't call it that anymore. But the Kaka'ako
Makai
development,
yes.
That didn't fly this past session. So how is OHA looking at that?
Great. Good question. We have dedicated, at least in this budget, a significant amount of resources to Kaka'ako Makai, centered around a couple different things. One of the things we are focused on is a Native Hawaiian cultural center down there in Kaka'ako Makai. And we're working with the city and county of Honolulu and working on some plan and designs for that. We're also looking at different parcels that are currently either vacant or have a unoccupied building on it, and how we can utilize assets to make those properties more productive. We're working with the Department of Hawaiian Homelands right now and having some conversations about some possible residential housing in Kaka'ako Makai, and we have a pretty good plan, and we're working on it, and we have the amount of resources that we've dedicated to this budget to do that.
You know, just had a conversation earlier with Keith Vieira, and he was talking about some ideas that we could steal from other places that highlight the arts and create a magnet for people to come and buy, and not just the Made in Hawaii thing that we see
yeah.
a couple times a year, but
yeah.
someplace that's open every single day
yeah.
to draw the people down to the gathering place, to
sure.
the area.
We're in the process of finishing OHA's real estate strategic, tactical, and operational business plans that manage our investment development lands and our legacy lands. And so that will help drive our future efforts in Kaka'ako Makai. Something else that's happening is the Hawaii Community Development Authority, through an appropriation from the legislature, has been tasked by the ledge to go out to community and do community consultations and studies over the next year to 2 years on the different types of land uses and zoning uses in Kaka'ako Makai. We OHA plans to be a part of those conversations, and one of the things that they are and have been asked by the legislature to really take a good hard look at is the residential component. And so we are going to be participating in those efforts, and we'll see what those results are. We believe that having residential development in Kaka'ako Makai is a good thing, and we want to be part of the affordable housing solution here in urban Honolulu, and we'll see what HCA does.
And, you know, when we last talked, I know you had said that one option would be a land swap if that idea wasn't palatable and you couldn't get buy-in from people.
It's possible. I still think, though, there's so much potential in Kaka'ako Makai that would be a last resort. If we would do any type of land swap, we possibly would partner with DHHL, who has unique special zoning and residential housing powers through the Hawaiian Homes Commission Act. And they may be able to do something pretty similar to like what they're doing on the Bolodrome property in Mo'ili'ili, where they're doing leasehold residential for the DHHL waitlisters. And that maybe that's an option too. At the end of the day, you need people to impact a community. The best example of when you don't have residential to impact an area is the Aloha Tower Marketplace, right? Which today is the home of one of our universities here in Hawaii. You have to have people that can activate an area. And we think residential is a key part of Kaka'ako Makai. And maybe it won't happen while I'm at OHA, but maybe it will happen when there's a future legislator, future trustees. But I think OHA retaining the Kaka'ako Makai parcels is something that we find very, very important for the future mission of OHA.
Switching gears on you, what about the decision to pull the lawsuit back on the Mauna Kea Authority?
You know, that was something that the trustees felt was the right time to do, given the lack of funding from the National Science Foundation for the 30-meter telescope, the work that the new Mauna Kea Stewardship and Oversight Authority has been doing, and the quality of people that serve on that oversight authority, led by John DeFries. And there's a lot of really good people on there. And so we're supportive of it. We want to hopefully be added to the Stewardship Oversight Authority, which would take the legislature to do that. But we are in discussions with Governor Green, and we're willing to give it a chance. You know, OHA's first lawsuit was from 2017. You know, that was approaching almost 10 years. The second lawsuit that was challenging the constitutionality of the Mauna Kea Stewardship Oversight Authority, we were going to have to take those to trial very, very soon. And it's never a good thing when the state is suing the state. So we decided to withdraw those lawsuits, give the Stewardship Oversight Authority a chance, and be a partner in a more collaborative future and solution for Mauna Kea. And so far, that's been pretty well received.
Okay. And I understand that you are dabbling in Substack.
Yeah, I'm enjoying that. I wrote this piece. There was about maybe a month ago when one of the local news ran a story that current state senator Brenton Awa was considering taking on current U.S. Representative Jill Tokuda, who replaced me in Congress. And from various different text threads I was on, I wasn't feeling it from the responses I was getting from people who weren't really taking Senator Awa's challenge seriously. And so I just put some thoughts down on the Substack, and I actually wrote it, and then I sent it out to a local particular media source that never replied to me. They didn't even get back to me. So I decided, you know what, I'm just going to create my own Substack and post it. And I did. And then now I've posted a few others about Pohakuloa and Aloha Aina, and most recently some of the challenges we've experienced at the Office of Hawaiian Affairs over the course of the last week surrounding our budget. And it's been pretty well received, actually. People, I think, are enjoying reading some of the thoughts that I have on issues that are important to Hawaii. And it, you know, gives me a chance to express that as well.
Well, Kai Kahele, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks today for having us. We really appreciate it and really excited about this budget.
All right. Mahalo.
Mahalo, Catherine.
That was OHA Chairman and former U.S. Congressman Kai Kahele talking about the future of OHA and where he's hoping to help take the office. Well, we're out of time, so we have to go now. But tomorrow we plan to talk airports. Honolulu regularly ranks at the bottom of the list. What can we learn from one airport that travelers voted the best airport in the nation 4 years in a row? It's in New Orleans. What do you think about our airports? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email us, talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find our shows online by searching for The Conversation, or on Spotify or Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.